Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. John Cady has been writing poems for more than a half century. He's earned awards and national renown, including the Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize and the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award. But here in Milwaukee, he might be better known for his years of service to philosophy as a professor and now distinguished professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee.
Aficionados of all of his work will gather Friday evening at Boswell Book Company to hear Cady read from his new collection of poems, Walking Backwards, Poems 1966 to 2016. He shared a couple when he joined us for a conversation recently. John Cady, welcome back to the program.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I always enjoy this.
There is a poem that starts off this collection that is more recent, I think, than the others in the collection. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little about it and then and read it for us.
Yes, it's a poem called English 206, and I wrote it after the book had been put together, the poems had been compiled. And it the title refers to a course I took my sophomore year at Princeton in 1965, where I first read modern poetry. I'd been intent on becoming a theoretical physicist, though I read a lot of modernist fiction in high school. But once I started college, my interests changed, and I finally read modern poetry in this course, and it just dazzled me, and I didn't quite understand what it was, but I knew I wanted to try to do that too, whatever it turned out to be. So I wrote this poem after I'd put the book together, which looks back on that. It's called English 206. It was actually taught by Carlos Baker, who was Ernest Hemingway's first biographer, and I guess quite an important figure at the time. English 206. Why would anyone even want to do it anymore? 52 years ago, I didn't know what it was, and yet I knew I wanted to do it too. Like the idea of a mind the self aspires to, the self a mind endeavors to become. I still don't and still do. Yeats and Frost, Pound and Eliot, Stevens, Moore, seen as from a peak in Darien in a college course with a syllabus, lectures twice a week, a final exam. It might not sound transformative, but in an incidental way, what I am now, what I'll die as, and how I'll linger on for the small while that constitutes an afterlife, was there from the first day. The urgency, the anxiety, the sense of something insisting to be said again before the mystery and necessity drifted away. It looks different now. What's become of poetry are different kinds of poets, i.e., different kinds of people, having nothing much in common but the name. I miss the echo chamber, where you studied to become something unforeseen, recognizable in retrospect. I miss the mystery, the feeling of history gradually unfolding, and the way it made no sense at all until it did. In the afternoon of the author, everything is there to see. No one told me when I was starting out, that day so long ago, that things become more and more familiar. Then suddenly you're old, with nothing to do and nothing stretching out before you to infinity, reducing whatever you did or had to say to a footnote, skipped over in the changing afternoon light, that finally becomes, at best, part of the narrative in a MoMA of the mind. But I'm glad I did it anyway.
John Cady reading English 206, the poem that opens his collection, Walking Backwards. First of all, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
What was it in that classroom in Princeton in 1965 that so radically changed your thinking about what you wanted to do with your life?
Well, I'd around the same time I was switching from physics and math to philosophy, so it was and then I also decided to start writing poetry. I stopped running track and started smoking, so it was a kind of complete collapse into decadence. But there was just something, as I said, I'd had an interest in modernist fiction, but I'd never read modernist poetry. And there just seemed to be something about the work of people like T.S. Eliot that had a kind of ambition and way of seeing something about life and experience that I couldn't imagine grasping otherwise, and I just became driven to try to emulate that. And I think in retrospect, it really was the kind of intellectual ambition of the enterprise that struck me so powerfully. And poetry, of course, has changed a lot since then, and I think that's one thing that's become less prominent in it, but it certainly was central to it back there in 1965.
Well, what do you think, Poe? You mentioned, you say this in the poem you just read. What has changed about poetry today?
Well, just mechanically. I mean, when I was starting out, there was no writing program. And there were a few in the country, in Iowa, Columbia, maybe Johns Hopkins, I'm not sure. But it's become such an industry now that I think most of the poets I knew, and there were a lot of serious undergraduate poets, and we all hung out together and taught each other, really. But poets tended to be inspired by other poets that they first read and thought of as great in some sense and wanted to emulate them. I mean, there were a lot of divisions in the poetry world. There was a kind of mainstream, and then there were various alternatives to it, contained, say, in Donald Allen's New American Poetry, a kind of counter to the mainstream anthology. But I think wherever you stood on that, and I was very much anti-mainstream when I started out, you aspired to, I mean, it sounds corny, but you thought of the poets that inspired you as having achieved a kind of greatness that you wanted to emulate. And I think there certainly are as many gifted and talented poets, if not more, now than there were then. But I think there is no mainstream anymore, and it's really become more a kind of career that you set to, a career with benefits that you aspire to. Whereas no one I knew really ever thought of making a living out of writing poetry. It was something they wanted to do for its own sake. So it's not as though these developments are good or bad, but they just sort of color one's outlook towards it, and it seems to have changed.
Well, one imagines that there have been times throughout the years that musicians and composers have thought the same thing about.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think, I mean, those days were, at least as far as popular music goes, there's a kind of evolution from that as a form of, guitar heroism to a kind of commodification of it. So it's not peculiar to poetry, but poetry is more marginalized than it was then. It wasn't uncommon for famous poets to be on the cover of Life magazine or something then. It was central to the culture in a way it simply isn't anymore. I mean, T.S. Eliot, I think, read to a crowd of 16,000 people at the University of Minnesota, something that just seems inconceivable now.
Inconceivable but delicious.
Yes, yes.
What was the process of going through all of these old works? Do you think of this as the narrative arc of your poetry life?
Yes, in a way, yes. There have been a couple of shifts in it. When I first started out, my first model was people like T.S. Eliot, and then I became taken with the Black Mountain poets like Robert Duncan. But really, my career is, as it turned out, began when I discovered the New York School poets like John Ashbery and Frank O'Hara, and younger ones too, like Peter Sheldahl, who's now the art critic for the New Yorker. And when I first started writing in my present form, I really thought of myself as a kind of New York School poets and trying to emulate and be part of that world. College was very close to New York, so I knew a lot of those figures. And that was fine for a while, and the first selections in this book are from a book called Blue Vents, published in 1968. And I wanted to make those selections. They're just six poems, but they're entirely poems I wrote in college. A couple of years after that, around 1969, I think it was, I just began to find this whole idea of thinking of myself as a New York School poet very confining and kind of annoying, because one thing that goes with being part of a school is that you exclude things that aren't. And I just found I didn't want to be constrained in that way. So I started writing long, more lyrical, maybe more ambitious poems, and that seemed to go pretty well. And I stuck with that for quite a while. And then I think I finally, starting in the mid-80s, I think I lost my sense of being influenced by the poets who were still great heroes of mine, like John Ashbery and James Schuyler and others. And then there were I wrote a very long autobiographical poem called Falling Water, which was the first – that was in 1991, first autobiographical poem I'd really written. And then in the 2000s, I started writing what I think of as memory poems. Proust has always been one of my big influences, and I found the idea of just having a kind of Proustian recollection of some past event that's not particularly significant in itself was kind of a way of coming to terms with the passage of time, and that marked another shift in the evolution of my work. So
I thought that line in the poem you read about then suddenly you're old was
yes.
a particularly Proustian sounding sentiment.
Yes, though he didn't actually make it to be very
yeah,
old.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes, but it is. I mean, the passage of time has always been probably the central subject of my poetry in all of its phases. But there are just different ways of trying to write about time, and I found this kind of recollective way to be something I've continued to do, though not exclusively. So in selecting the poems, I tried to reflect some of those changes in the way I thought of my work.
You know, this almost seems like a pedestrian question, but there had to be so many more poems out there that didn't make the cut in putting this collection together. How did you know you were done? How did you know this was the right group?
Well, let's see. I did have a previous new and selected poems in 2002, so I started off with those selections and I modified them. I could have done – I'm sure the FSG would have done a collected poems if I'd wanted, but I didn't want that. For one thing, I thought it would be too long. There were a lot of poems in my first two or two and a half books that I really don't stand by, and I didn't want to republish those. I think at one period I kind of have a reputation as a very abstract poet, and while that's certainly true of some of my work, I think that's somewhat exaggerated. So I wanted to make the selections with an eye to variety. Also, there are poems of mine which I like individually, but which kind of resemble each other a little bit. So I wanted to, you know, try to minimize those resemblances. And I guess those were the principles that guided me. I wanted it to come in, you know, I didn't want it to go over 400 pages, so I had that in mind too.
As you say, there are a selection of poems that you wrote while you were still in college.
Yes.
And it strikes me that if you can look back after, you know, 50 years at things that you wrote in college and be pretty comfortable with it, you've done something right with your life.
Well, I suppose in a way I think of the book seems to me to be centered on college. I mean, that's when I started writing. The title poem, Walking Backwards, is what that refers to are those tours that prospective students take in April at colleges where someone is trying to convince them to come and talks to them walking backwards while he's talking. So it does seem to – I mean, college sort of seems to be a central part of my work. I'm not quite sure why. And that's why I chose the cover, since I associate college with foliage, and I didn't want – a literally collegiate cover, but I like the photograph of Tom Bamberger's photograph of this foliage. So yeah, I'm not sure why I find associate poetry with college, other than the obvious fact that that's when I started writing.
I wonder if to close you might be willing to read Selfie Stick.
Oh sure, this poem was, I think that's the next to the last poem in the book. It was written in Paris when we were there at Thanksgiving, 2 years ago? And there were all these tourists with taking pictures of themselves on selfie sticks.
And just amazing to think, you know, how far we've, you know, the idea of a selfie stick in 1965 or even
yes.
1985 would just be absurd.
Yes, it certainly would be. It's pretty absurd right now.
Exactly. Maybe no less absurd today.
Selfie stick. To snap yourself from half a life away, with the city of lights floating in the background and a smile frozen on the same face you wore on a day in 1985 in the garden of Hotel de Marnier, the hotel we're staying in now. On a day. What used to be a real time in an actual place isn't real anymore, although the person that I'd been is still real, and the eternal present I inhabit remains real too, at least for now. What holds it together is internal to it, like the music of the mirror that arises out of nowhere and continues forever, through the vagaries of adolescence and middle age and the fear of gradually getting old, until it ends abruptly, for no reason, on a random afternoon, the way a Patricia Highsmith character might die, in a freak fall on a nondescript street thousands of miles from home. It didn't happen, but something like it will in time, and then time ends. Life seems necessary from the inside, but from the outside it's contingent and terrifying, with the precariousness of existence written on its face. I keep waiting for the thing to happen, meanwhile holding it at arm's length, keeping it at bay.
John Cady, thank you so much, and come back and see us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure, Mitch.
John Cady's new book is called Walking Backwards, Poems, 1966 to 2016, and it's just out. He'll read from it and talk more Friday evening at Boswell Book Company.